Seems to me we have a lab exam that we probably should be talking about, though, right? Oh, and I forgot to tell Section 1, but there is someone from next quarter's Section 2 that needs to switch into Section 3. And the way the person described it is, well, I would think that someone wouldn't mind being able to sleep in and switch into Section 2. Now, I don't recommend that you do any of these section swappings at the moment, though, because if you give up your spot, then someone else could take it over, someone off the wait list or something like that. So where you're at, I would stay there for now. And then as soon as the first day of class comes next quarter, then we could do swapping around if some of you discover that you need to. So, in fact, I'll send an email around before class starts and ask, is there anybody that needs to swap sections? But just want to put that thought in your head, because I have had the first request come in for that. So as far as the lab quiz, there are exactly three topics. There is the theoretical aspect of kinetic versus thermodynamic control. There is the lab interpretation for kinetic versus thermodynamic control. And then there's everybody's favorite, NMR. Yes, which I kind of got on Section 3's case yesterday because I was just so blown out of the water that actually all three of you sections are doing this. Because how many of you worked those example problems that I gave? Okay, that's a hell of a lot better than the other sections were doing. I think I saw one or two timid hands. So explain to me the logic behind this. You have the instructor, the one that controls your grades. And you have that instructor that says, at the end of the quarter, you're going to have this kind of problem. And no matter what else might have been happening during this quarter, whatever changes have come, that has not changed, has it? Where I keep saying there's going to be NMR problems coming. There's going to be NMR problems coming. And then we started doing NMR problems. And I said, there'll be NMR problems coming. And then I gave you a couple example ones to practice. One of which was on a past year's lab exam. And yet, there's only the small number of you that raised your hands and said that you tried that problem. So I presume that there's some form of magic you all are aware of that's going to get you to the place you need to be by the time the lab exam comes on Monday. But what else do I do to convince you all of the need to work on these problems? And what will you do when you transfer, if you happen to, and not that all instructors for your institutions are like this, but we don't do research here. So in theory, we're here because we like to teach. There, they may like to teach, but they're employed because they're doing research. That's where money comes. So what are you going to do if you transfer? You get some class where the instructor simply says, go learn this topic, without then reminding you 50 times, because it's an upper division course, and that's the way things can work there. So we're going to review these NMR problems. I'm going to have one more we'll do as a class today. And I could recommend some book problems, although no one has asked. Again, knowing that this kind of problem is coming at the end of the quarter. I'm just putting this in perspective here, because regardless, I'm putting the question on the lab exam. So if you're ready, because you've been getting ready, good. And if you're in a panic right now, well, you've had a whole quarter's worth of warning. So then what can I do at this point? Just think about that, just in case next quarter there happens to be yet some other topic where at the beginning of the quarter I say, it's coming, because I know there's something. Next time around, believe the warning, because I know OChem sucks sometimes as far as all the stuff you've got to learn. You know, even if you're interested, you're like, oh, I have to go home because I'm going to be up till 4 in the morning studying OChem. And I already know someone else was like, oh, because they were telling the story of what happened to them, which is exactly the same thing that happened to me one time, which is that you're studying so much and you get so tired you can't stay awake. But the moment you sit down and close your eyes, all you see is benzene floating around, or molecules floating around. And so then you think, okay, I might as well wake up, because if I can't sleep, because all I'm seeing is molecules. But then as soon as you open your eyes, all the molecules disappear. You're looking at a page, and you realize 20 minutes later you've only read 3 words. So then you try to go back to sleep again, and there goes the dancing molecules again. And this is, you know, this is all when you're totally sober, too. So Anyways, I'm just worried that you all are going to pass the lab exam, because every quarter what happens is people do great in the lecture and bomb the lab exam, because I think that's the same speech I gave at the beginning of the quarter, which is everybody puts off studying for the lab until we have a lab exam.
Anyways, was that enough of a soapbox lecture?
Right.
So, the three topics are the two aspects of thermodynamic and kinetic control, and then NMR. So let's do the thermodynamic versus kinetic. And just to head off, this isn't actually happened too much in the other sections, but just to head off this potential situation, I'm not going to tell you how I ask this question. Because some people were starting to ask me, okay, well, if you ask it this way, if you ask it this way, if you ask it this way, I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about this topic. So I'm going to describe the topic, not give you a hint exactly how I'm going to ask the question. Because the situation is this. We have a compound, 1,3-butadiene, that if you allow it to undergo some kind of electrophilic addition, that you do form one and only one kind of carbocation. And in fact, we had discussed that fact to some length because there are two resonance structures we could write for that carbocation, but they're misleading because it makes it look like you could have either a primary carbocation, if you put the carbocation at the very end of the molecule, or two carbons over, where it would be in a secondary position, that would be another kind of carbocation. But those structures don't exist because it really is a delocalized ion in real life. So I know that I normally do not write dotted lines, and I recommend against it. The only reason it's good, I think, in this one case is because it emphasizes the fact there's only one energy level involved. Once, though, you start to finish the reaction, because the example we did was to add HBr. So there's a bromine that's going to come in and form a bond. As the bond forms, you lose delocalization. In fact, you have localization of charge. So were you to form the bond to a primary position, the positive charge starts to accumulate on that primary position. If you're going to form the bond to the secondary position, the delta positive, the partial charge, ends up at the secondary position. And it is still true that primary carbocations, or the semblance of a primary carbocation, is not as good as having a secondary. Which means that as this common intermediate starts to react, there's going to be two different activation energies. One corresponding to forming at the primary, which will be the higher activation energy, and one corresponding to forming a bond at the secondary position, which will be the lower activation energy. So we have the following. One curve up to the carbocation, two curves progressing away from it. Again, for the transition state for the higher energy curve, that would correspond to bond formation beginning. Oh, sorry. Let me try that again. Bond formation beginning at the primary position, which means the double bond becomes localized internally. That's the higher energy transition state. The lower energy transition state would be where the double bond becomes localized terminally. And again, the bromine starts to attach at the secondary position.
But once this process is over, you have two different products, an internal alkene and a terminal alkene. Those have different energies to them. And it turns out terminal alkenes are not thermodynamically as favorable normally as internal alkenes.
So let me write those two products then. So the whole point is, the reaction pathway that has the higher activation energy ends up making the more favorable product. And the one that has the lower activation energy makes the less favorable product. Because these graphs cross, that's why we have some interesting behavior that occurs as temperature changes. Because if you had two reactions, competing reactions, where the rougher reaction, the tougher reaction, is also the less favorable reaction, changing temperature would only change the rate at which the products form. Possibly a little bit in the product distribution as well. But here we have a total flip-flop. Because at low temperature, there's not much energy around. And so if there are two competing processes that have two different activation barriers, we could show that at some fixed temperature that's going to have a certain energy distribution to it, that if we have a low activation barrier, that there's going to be a lot more molecules that would have the energy to be able to react compared to a high activation barrier. And this is just talking about the forward reaction. For an exothermic process like this, the reverse reactions automatically have larger activation barriers, which means the reverse reaction rates are automatically lower. So at low enough temperature, we presume that the reaction overall is irreversible, and that therefore the product is going to be determined by which of the two activation areas barriers can be overcome. Again, on the basis of this graph below, which we had seen at the time, and some of you have seen a zillion times now, because the lower activation barrier has more molecules that would have the energy to react, we make more of that product, which is not the most favorable product. That's why we call it the kinetic product. Now, as we increase temperature, what happens? Well, if we were just looking at one activation barrier and looking at how temperature would affect the reaction rate, we can see that at low temperature, the distribution is narrower, the curve is less broad, and it is, of course, shifted to lower energy. As we raise temperature, the distribution broadens, and, of course, the average energy shifts higher because we're at higher temperature. The point of drawing that graph is to show that at low temperature, there's not as many molecules that have the energy to react. At higher temperature, there are more molecules able to react. So as you keep increasing temperature, reverse reaction rate becomes higher and higher. So does the forward reaction rate, meaning you have reversibility possible. But now, even though the kinetic product may form more easily, still, reversibility is also more possible, and if it reacts to make the thermodynamically more favorable product, that product doesn't really want to reverse, because it is the lowest energy of all of the species on this graph, and so it has the highest activation energy to reverse. So, increase the temperature, increase the reversibility, influence and favor the formation of that more favorable product, which we therefore call the thermodynamic product. Now, I've described two extremes, but you could have some situation in between. In other words, if you heat it up a little bit, you'll make it a little bit more reversible and a little bit more likely that the thermodynamic product will form. But that means you could end up with a lot of both products. It's only when you're extremely high or extremely low in temperature that you can more successfully target just the formation of one product. That is the theoretical side of this lab. So are there any questions on this first part of the material? And don't ask me, are you going to have to draw all three of these graphs? I don't know, because I haven't actually written it yet. I have an idea what I want to ask. But questions about the material? Yes?
kinetic and the thermodynamic product. So
that should be the only one that forms then. If you can show me that example later, I would like to look over it, but my instinct tells me that's the one that forms because it's favored under both circumstances. But I'm not going to actually ask you some alternate example. The one thing I will tell you is it will be this molecule and this reaction that I ask about. In this part of it, the theoretical part, when we get to the interpretation part, that will be directly related to your lab. Again, no new example there. So if there aren't questions about this, let's review the lab part, which I know we did more recently because we talked about lab reports, but let's still review. So we had two initial compounds, cyclohexanone and furaldehyde. Two furaldehyde, technically. One of them was in part A, one of them was in part B, so I think I did the same thing the other day where I labeled the two compounds A and B, and they both react with a semicarbazide. So you might recall that we had discussed that the nitrogens that are right next door to the carbonyl are not likely to participate in a reaction as easily because they're too involved with delocalization with that carbonyl. So it is only the amino group on the left, the very end of the molecule, that's going to react. And so if you treat the rest of it as R, then again, the mechanism for forming these derivatives is identical to the one we just saw in lecture for the formation of an imine. Just everywhere you have an alkyl group, replace it with this NHCONH2 instead. So you do form two different derivatives, which for brevity's sake I'll call A prime and B prime. And in parts A and B of the experiment, we separately made A prime and then separately made B prime. Why did we make those separately? Because our characterization was by melting point alone. And so we had to be able to get the pure melting points of each of the derivatives, which you don't have to memorize the temperatures. I'm just reminding us that one melted at 166, one melted at 202. Recall that there is no connection between stability and melting point. There is a coincidental correspondence between the higher temperature melting point and the fact that it is the thermodynamic product, or the fact that at lower temperature melting point, that is the kinetic product. Coincidence. Now, what was part C about? Well, after making the two individual derivatives, we wanted to see which one formed in greater quantity at low versus high temperature. We also did a middle temperature run just to see if we might get a mixture of the two products. So when we conducted the experiment at low temperature, which means we should be forming the kinetic product, we ended up with a melting point that more closely matched A's derivative in terms of temperature, which means the formation of the semicarbazone from A is the kinetic process. Then when we did the reaction at high temperature, we ended up with a mixture that had a melting point that more closely matched B prime, the derivative from B, which means forming B prime was the thermodynamic process. And then when you did the room temperature run, you should have gotten some mixture that had a melting point that was somewhere in between the two derivatives. Now, we discussed already that wasn't necessarily what your results showed, but that's the behavior you should have had. Yes?
So the A prime and B prime, is this supposed to be the reference melting points?
These are the reference melting points, so that's when you do it individually. Then what I just described, part C, is where you have both of these reagents at the same time in reaction mixture.
So A prime is always the reference melting point?
Yes.
A
prime is always the reference, yes. And so what you did is the low temperature run should have matched more closely that reference, which means it is the kinetic product. Then the high temperature run more closely matched B prime, so that meant it was the thermodynamic product. Then part E, what we did is we tried to do a swap. We put A prime
and B together. Realize that A prime has semi-carbazide that has been reacted with it already. But if A is the kinetic product, that means it could reverse and release the semi-carbazide, which could then react with B to make B prime. But that only occurs if A prime is the kinetic product. And can therefore reverse. If this happens, you end up with B prime, which is the thermodynamic product, which should again have a temperature that more matches the reference B prime. Now, if we also try doing the reverse case, but in real life, that should not have happened, because if A prime is the kinetic product, B prime is the thermodynamic product and doesn't want to reverse. And so you won't form A prime. So notice that regardless of which combination you do, in both cases, we end up with a thermodynamic product. And so both of these reversibility reactions, in this instance, should have given us the higher melting point to match B prime, which is the thermodynamic product. That's the lab interpretation portion of this experiment. So any questions on that part? You all have that relatively satisfied look that it makes somewhat sense. Or enough sense that you know you'll be able to get it once you go off and study. Am I right? So let's get to the tough part. And actually, let me jump to the end here so I don't forget to mention something. That there are not going to be any more lab reports for this quarter. And I just made somebody's day. And that it's for there's a multitude of reasons, not all of them which are good. There is the fact that I do care more about NMR right. Because IR is a relatively easy technique. For those of you that were with me last quarter, or when we did discuss the first couple labs, you're just looking for bonds appearing and disappearing. There is some art to that, and we should investigate more examples of that, but we do have all of next quarter to do that. We have to get through NMR, and so I'm making the decision to focus on NMR and have you focus on studying for NMR. Versus the IR. Now, there's some other aspects to it as well, which is I'm now in a mountain of work that's about this high, and even though this is totally unethical, I just can't handle making the mountain any higher right now. And all you would be doing on these lab reports anyways is saying the same sentence over and over again. This bond disappeared, this one appeared, so I made the product. This bond disappeared, this one appeared, so I made the product. Well, so what? I made the product too. I didn't even make the product, but I took these IRs from this person that had these results, so here are the same results. You know? So, I mean, I'm trying to justify that something that's not justifiable, but this has been one of the most, I'm going to remember this year from now on. This will be when I retire, I look back and, oh, that year. So, you're just getting off easy is what it is, but it's not easy in the sense that you did it to yourself, that you didn't study the NMR, so you give them the chance to focus on NMR by not having to do those other lab reports. All right. Now, some people, though, had expressed an interest, and they said, but I want to know if I've got my product. You know, that's a perfectly admirable desire. So if you wanted to finish up and take an IR of your other experiment, so you, your own self, are satisfied that you did it, I encourage that. If you've already finished or don't want to carry through to the end of the experiments then, because there's going to be no lab report for it, at least clean up today, because we're going to be doing group checkout. And in fact, it's going to be slightly different than what we did last quarter, I think, because what I will have us do is we'll get all our glassware out like we did last quarter, but then I'll call out an item and everyone will hold that item up at once. And then the next time we'll do the same thing, and the next item we'll do the same thing. So we're all checking out at the same time. Now, those of you who are really fast are realizing, crap, if he has us all
hold up the piece of glassware at the same time, he's going to know whether or not I have that piece of glassware or not. The other reason we're going to do the checkout that way. Ah, I've seen those looks now, yes. Because every year I know what happens. I go to one person, I check out, and when I turn around, there's a piece of glassware that goes to someone else. You know, I'm not that dumb. I know that goes on. But I just got to be one step smarter than figure out how to not have that happen, right? So, anyways. Now, with all that preamble, let's do the NMR. Trying to finish grading that tonight for your section.
No, I mean that you say that we don't need the lab report for lab 3 and 4, that will be a little bit.
3 or 4 or 6 or 7.
Yeah. When will that be?
The lab reports?
No, the lab quiz thing.
I think that Anthony over there is encouraging you to stop asking that question, hoping that I won't recognize that the question was asked and forget that we even need to worry about that material.
No, I don't remember.
Exactly. Very good.
What did I just ask?
I don't know. I don't speak Cantonese, so I don't know.
Good one.
Although, was it in this section where I did a very quick ni hao ma to someone that walked in the door and they kind of went, what? That came out of him? I think that was the other section. But I forget, in Cantonese it's li instead of ni?
Lei.
And which one? Lei, lei, lei. Or...
Lei.
Okay. Okay. Since I quoted all these values, I won't read them off again for the recording, since I did it previously, but did anybody get an answer to this problem? Okay, what do you think? Name the compound that you think it is. What words you're gonna? So, put your two answers together. It is trans-hex-2-ene. And that's the correct answer. Now, I cheated a little bit. If you look at your original notes, I had a coupling constant of 14 originally. But since that technically could be within the range of both cis and trans, you would have had the legitimate way to say, wait, I don't know which one you're trying to broadcast. So I will make sure that in problems I ask you that the coupling constants are obvious as to which range they would fall in. For example, if you had a coupling constant of 7, it couldn't be trans. If you had a coupling constant of 15, it couldn't be cis. If you had something like was 3 or 4, you know it would have to be general. So what's the degree of unsaturation that we have here? We have 1 degree of unsaturation. We also have no heteroatoms. We only have carbon and hydrogen. So the only way we can get a chemical shift that is this high is to have an alkene or benzene. Of course, we have enough carbons for benzene, but way too many absorbances and too many hydrogens, and not enough degrees of unsaturation. So because we have degree of unsaturation equal to 1, and chemical shift greater than 5, it means it's an alkene, which since J is equal to 15, that means it is a trans alkene. Yes? Quite observant. So coupling constants exist anytime that splitting happens. So all of these have coupling constants. But I've only been reporting coupling constants for alkenes. Because for all these other cases, for our purposes in MR, it doesn't matter to know the coupling constants. It's not useful information. But for alkenes it is, because it lets us know if we have geminal, cis, or trans protons. So, yes, for this quarter, if you see a coupling constant, it's a big, huge, fat hint you got an alkene somewhere. Now, since we do have an alkene, that means there's no ring, because there's only one degree of unsaturation. So now, both Taku and Amelia, you got the answer. Did anybody else happen to get the right answer? You did. Okay. Would any of you like to volunteer or explain how you reasoned it out? Like, tell me where you started with your approach. Go ahead. If you'd like. Oh, you did too? Okay. Yes, I am. You had the appearance of wanting to participate, so I'm letting you. The first two peaks? Okay. Now, I know what you're saying. You're saying an alkene is going to have one hydrogen on each position of it if you know that you have a transalkene. But let me emphasize something here. We do have only two hydrogens that have an integral of one. If this was a terminal alkene, you'd have to have a third hydrogen there. Or this is one other situation in which you could only have two hydrogens, but then you'd only have geminal splitting. So the fact that we have trans and we only have two hydrogens that integrate to one means there has to be an alkyl group on each of the other positions of that double bond. And that's where you started from. And then you were saying something about a doublet. So, for example, the top peak, which is a doublet of triplets. What's the implication of that?
Doublets. Well, I see two doublets.
Right.
So that means splitting caused by each other.
Okay. So, remember that all the positions in an alkene are chemically unique from each other, even if I did have another hydrogen on the same carbon. Because they're permanently in different relationship to the other groups on the double bond, they're all different from each other. So if you look at the first two peaks, the one that do have such a high chemical shift, one of them has to be this hydrogen, one of them has to be the other hydrogen. So knowing how much room I have left to write all this in, I'm going to make the very top absorbance correspond to this bottom carbon, just arbitrarily. I have my nice set of new... And I have more colors to play with. So I'm declaring that to be the first peak, which means the next peak is the other alkene hydrogen. And so the first peak is split by the second peak is split by the first. But now, what does the other information from the first peak tell us? That's right. So next to the bottom hydrogen, which is the first peak, we do have one neighbor on one side that causes the doublet, but then we have to have two different neighbors, equivalent to each other, that are on the other side. In other words, we have this. That's the significance of a triplet. How is that useful at all? We know that the chain has to keep going because we only have carbon. We can only have two hydrogens at this position, which means there must be a carbon that continues on. And you're saying that the next position also has to have two hydrogens? How do we know that for sure? Okay, but how do we know that from splitting? Because which one of the remaining peaks corresponds to the green hydrogens?
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be, the green hydrogen, yes, has to correspond to one of the peaks that integrates only to two, because there's two hydrogens. One of those is a doublet of triplets, one of those is a triplet of quartets. Which one must it be? The doublet of triplets, because from the green hydrogen perspective, look back where we came from. There's only one neighbor on the left-hand side. One neighbor means splitting into a doublet. We fail to have a doublet in the other peak that integrates to two, so that other peak that integrates to two cannot be the green hydrogens. And now I'm getting that deer in the headlight look, so I'll say this again. We started with the alkene. Everybody's okay with the fact it's an alkene? Gets that part? Is everybody okay with the fact we have a transalkene because of the coupling concept? So then we choose one place to start. And actually, the other way to work this problem, and maybe some of you did this, is start with the things that integrate to three because they're methyl groups and that they're at the end of a molecule. And then you can work your way inward. But this approach actually works because if we start out with that top hydrogen, again, we know there's a doublet of triplets. Doublet means one here. Triplet means two here. And that's what we got, one and two. We then need to figure out which one corresponds to these green ones. And there's only two peaks that integrate to two. I know which one it is because it has to have a doublet because from the green proton's perspective, there is only one neighbor on one of the sides. Right?
Let me write some of this down, I guess. All right, so we've identified which of the two peaks that integrates to two would correspond to the green hydrogens. Now we can see there is also a triplet for those hydrogens, which is the confirmation that, yes, we do have more neighbors down the chain. And because there's only two neighbors, we know that the chain goes forward at least one more position. Orange, you'll be missed. All right. So, we only have one more peak that integrates the two, so that must be the red hydrogens, which split the green ones into a triplet, and which are split by the green ones into a triplet. Notice what other splitting we have at that location. We have a quartet. That means the neighbor must be a methyl group. There are only two peaks that integrate to three. One or the other of them must be the methyl group. Which one is it? The bottom one, because it is split into a triplet, which would match having those two red hydrogens as neighbors. And that matches because those three hydrogens only have the two red hydrogens next door, and so they are split into a triplet. So it is self-consistent. We only have one other peak, which is good because we only have one carbon left. Notice that we've used five of the six carbons. Automatically, that means the last thing to put on there is a methyl group, which corresponds to the other peak that integrates to three. And which would be split into a doublet due to the one neighbor on the alkene that it has. Questions on this problem?
So one degree of unsaturation is either a ring or an alkene.
That's correct. Or, so once you determine it's an alkene, because there's only one degree, it can't be a ring. Shall we move to the second problem? Anybody think they got the answer for this one? What's the name? Furan? You're close. You may have the right... Is it a six-membered ring with an oxygen in it that's got a double bond? Five-member ring? Five carbons and then an oxygen up top, and it's a ring and it has a double bond. So what molecule is that? That we just saw in part of our answers in lecture earlier ago. It's DHP. This is the spectrum of DHP. Now, let's see how we can get to this answer. And I'm going to admit, this is a tougher problem, which is why I don't put it on the lab exam anymore, but I do it as an example to scare the crap out of people. Wait, I'm not supposed to reveal teacher secrets like that. So, what degree of unsaturation do we have?
Two.
Which means there's several possibilities. It could be a triple bond. It could have two alkenes. It could have an alkene and a carbonyl. It could have an alkene and a ring. It could have a carbonyl and a ring. Or it could have two rings.
You might think, wow, that doesn't do us any good. Well, no, not necessarily. Because given the degree of unsaturation, the fact that we have coupling constants, and the fact that we have a chemical shift above 5... What functional group likely do we have? an alkene again, right?
Well, if we have one alkene, that automatically means it can't be the carbonyl in the ring, it can't be the ring in the ring, it can't be a triple bond. And
given that we only have two hydrogens,
then I'm guessing it's probably not a double alkene either.
Because if we had two alkenes with this limited number of carbons, we should have more alkene hydrogens. So here are only two possibilities. It's cyclic with an alkene, or it's got a carbonyl and an alkene.
That's going to be important later on, but let me write down the justification for this. Gesundheit.
Now, what kind of alkene do we have? Cis.
All right. So let's just start with that. And let's say that I, again, arbitrarily start with one of these positions. And I'll start with the top peak again.
So notice that that is a double. Which makes sense because we do have a neighbor there.
Which is the other alkene peak. And so that is in fact split by the first one. Wrong one. Too many colors.
But notice it's only a doublet. So what does that mean? Well, there has to be something at this position. You can't have an alkene and just have a hydrogen. There has to be something here that's not a hydrogen. And has to be something there that doesn't have hydrogens on it. In other words, it has to be some kind of structural feature that blocks splitting. So we'll leave that alone at the moment. But there's only a very limited number of things that can block splitting. We could put an oxygen there, as long as it wasn't an alcohol. We can guess that it's not an alcohol, because there's nothing else that integrates to one. So it could be an ether. Maybe it's a carbonyl. Carbonyls, if it's not an aldehyde, also lack the ability to split.
So I'll just suggest that is probably either a carbonyl or an oxygen.
Let's work on the other side of the molecule, though, and see if that helps us at all. So we go to the second peak, which is a doublet of triplets.
The fact that it's a triplet also means it has two hydrogen neighbors.
Now, the same type of thing that we have before.
We have three peaks, actually,
that integrate to two. But this can only be one of them. Which one? Triplet of triplets? Are you sure? Because from the green hydrogen's perspective, how many neighbors do you know it has up above? But they're on different carbons, aren't they? the two hydrogens I've got so far. So really, right next door, there's only one neighbor, isn't there? And if there's only one neighbor, what kind of splitting must it have? Doublet. Because remember, one means doublet, two triplet, three quartet, four quintet, like that. So if it has to have a doublet, the only peak that would work is this fourth one. Which, what's the use of that? In fact, sorry, let me write this note down. It's also a triplet, which means it has one more neighbor that has two hydrogens on it. Now, here's the tricky part of this question. I've so far used up four carbons. How many carbons do I have left? Only one. How many hydrogens have I used up? Six. How many more are left? Two. Both of those hydrogens have to be on that carbon. Because if I have an oxygen, it's an ether. Because I already determined it's not an alcohol. If it's not an alcohol, if it is an ether, it can't hold any hydrogens. So the carbon must have both hydrogens. Now I've got two choices. Three. One, which I think is the obviously wrong answer, is that the carbon is sitting out here in space. Because how else could I have no splitting right here? If I put that carbon that has the two hydrogens on it at this position, I'm going to split this hydrogen, which it can't do. So that's the wrong answer. The only other choice is to put it down here, which works. Because if I did put one more carbon with two hydrogens there, then the red hydrogens would have two neighbors on both sides, which would make it the triplet of triplets. Is only one more peak left, so it corresponds to those last two hydrogens. And now we've used up all of the atoms except oxygen. And since we demonstrated, therefore, that there's no carbonyl, it has to be a ring. Because that was the only other possibility that gives us 2 degrees of unsaturation. So not having to do the problem myself, I can stand back and say this is a beautiful problem. But it's sneaky. So you're unlikely to have something this complicated. However, the first problem we did is a perfectly acceptable problem. Because it doesn't require any severe jumps of logic. It just requires being able to analyze splitting and integration. Now, would we like that last practice problem to chew on a little bit? And I'll tell you the way I came up with this other problem, because it's probably the way I'm going to write the lab exam. I have that database that I have the link to on my website, and I thought, okay, what functional groups do I want to put in there? I thought, I want a ketone and an alkene, okay? How many carbons do I want? I said, 5, why not? And so I've looked and see, okay, how many alkene ketones are there spectra of on the website? 3 or 4. Okay, what's that one look like? Messy, too nasty. What's that one look like? Oh, that looks okay. And that became this problem. which happens to have the same formula and therefore degree of unsaturation as the first problem. Entirely different molecule, though. The spectral information for this one6.34 for a doublet of doublets with one hydrogen that has two coupling constants, 8.7 hertz and 17.5 hertz.
Then fine. We'll do another one.
Yes.
Wait, what's wrong? The answer's right there.
Oh. Can we talk about this one as well? For a little bit.
Where is it? Oh, okay. If most of you didn't see this already, we'll just go ahead and do this problem. It makes no sense to look at the answer because then you didn't use your brains. So I'll continue quoting then. Next one, 6.23, which is a doublet of doublets that is degrades to 1 with coupling constants of 3.3 and 17.5 hertz. 5.811, that's a doublet of doublets that integrates to 1 with coupling constants of 3.3 and 8.7 hertz. By the way, don't worry about what J1 and J2 mean. I'm just trying to say there's two different coupling constants, and that's all I mean by the ones and twos. There are two more peaks. 2.616, that's a quartet that integrates to 2. And 1.112, that's a triplet that integrates to 3. Take 10 minutes. Try to solve the structure. Someone had just asked, should we start with the methyl group on this last problem? And yes, but you're not going to get very far. And let's see why. Because we do have something that integrates to 3, so yes, we know there's at least a methyl group. And the methyl group has what kind of splitting? Triplet, which means it has how many neighbors? Only two neighbors. Well, there is a peak that integrates to 2. Which the important realization there is that peak that does integrate to 2 only has a quartet. Which means we're in the same situation again where we can't have any splitting. But there's not quite enough information per se to figure out what would go here to block the splitting. Although we might be able to make some educated guesses because we could put one carbon there, which would leave two more carbons. So you could put two more carbons on that carbon, plus an oxygen, which would give us an alcohol, but we would have just created a molecule with no degrees of unsaturation. So the only other logical choice would be the unoxygen or carbonyl, just like in the previous problem. But let's leave that for a moment and look at the rest of the information that we have. Because we have an alkene. Again, 2 degrees of unsaturation, chemical shift greater than 6, and for this quarter, the fact that we have coupling information means we have an alkene. What kind of alkene? Terminal. Why?
Well, if it's a terminal alkene, we have 3 different kinds of hydrogens. We know that there is geminal splitting. So, in fact, I'll just go
go ahead and label this middle peak here in red.
And how did I determine that that peak corresponded to that particular hydrogen? Well, it has geminal splitting,
but a shift of 17 point, not shift, coupling constant of 17.5 means that we have trans. Which that red hydrogen is trans to the hydrogen that is on the other carbon. And it's split by the two remaining hydrogens, which I'll go ahead and color in magenta and black. Now, which of the remaining two hydrogens is which? Well, there's only one other peak that does have geminal splitting. And that one has a cis relationship, which matches the 8.7 coupling constant. Actually, I made these magenta and green. So we have one hydrogen left. It has both a cis and a trans relationship, which means it must correspond to the first peak. Notice that all of three of these are doublets of doublets, which if you pick any one hydrogen, there's two other hydrogens that would be nearby that could split. This is an unusual case because we do have one carbon where the two hydrogens split each other. It's not the only situation we could have that. Technically, if we had a diastereotopic proton, we could also have splitting within the same carbon. But look again at the leftmost of these hydrogens, the one that corresponds to the top peak. We have a doublet of doublets of nothing else. That again means that we end up in a situation where the neighbor cannot have splitting. Now, how many carbons have we used up so far?
Four?
Yes.
How many hydrogens have we used up?
Eight. There are only eight hydrogens. So we have a carbon, and we have an oxygen, which means we have what? A carbonyl. This is the answer. Pent-1-ene-3-one. Yes.
So if we don't have the carbonyl at
this position.
Yeah.
Then so we might have an oxygen.
No, so if we have the splitting, so will it be something like doublet of something?
Yes. If we had a carbon here with two hydrogens, then this one would be a doublet of triplets. So you have triple splitting, meaning three different kinds of neighbors. Now, how many of you got this problem? Oh. How many of you are going to be doing a lot of NMR practice over the weekend? Any more questions? Then at this point, you are either trying to complete your experiments and run some IRs, or you're working on cleaning out your lockers. We're not doing checkout today, though, because the stockroom does want us all to do the, however we do it, to do the checkout at a class. If you are finished, do remember there are going to be other people with chemicals and glassware out, so we all do need our goggles on.